Good. Tell me about it. You don't understand. You simply don't understand. It is not a field in which anyone but myself has done research. There is nothing historical, nothing firm, nothing real. People talk about Earth as though it's a fact, and also as though it's a myth. There are a million contradictory tales. Well, then, what has your research consisted of? I've been forced to collect every tale, every bit of supposed history, every legend, every misty myth, even fiction. Anything that includes the name of Earth or the idea of a planet of origin. For over 30 years, I've been collecting everything I could find from every planet of the galaxy. Now, if I could only get something more reliable than all of these from the Galactic Library, But you don't want me to say the word. That's right. Don't say it. Tell me instead that one of these items has caught your attention, and tell me your reasons for thinking why it of them all should be legitimate. Pellerat shook his head. There, Golan, if you will excuse my saying so, you talk like a soldier or a politician. That's not the way history works. Treviz took a deep breath and kept his temper. Tell me how it works, Genoff. We've got 2 days. Educate me. You can't rely on any one myth, or even on any one group. I've had to gather them all, analyze them, organize them, set up symbols to represent different aspects of their content. Tales of impossible weather, astronomic details of planetary systems at variance with what actually exists, place of origin of culture heroes specifically stated not to be native, quite literally hundreds of other items. No use going through the entire list. Even 2 days wouldn't be enough. I've spent over 30 years, I tell you. I then worked up a computer program that searched through all these myths for common components and sought a transformation that would eliminate the true impossibilities. Gradually, I worked up a model of what Earth must have been like. After all, if human beings all originated on a single planet, that single planet must represent the one fact that all original myths, all culture hero tales, have in common. Well, do you want me to go into mathematical detail? Treviz said, "Not at the moment, thank you." But how do you know you won't be misled by your mathematics? We know for a fact that Terminus was founded only 5 centuries ago, and that the first human beings arrived as a colony from Trantor, but had been assembled from dozens, if not hundreds, of other worlds. Yet someone who did not know this could assume that Harry Seldon and Salver Hardin, neither of whom were born on Terminus, came from Earth, and that Trantor was really a name that stood for Earth. Certainly, if the Trantor, as described in Seldon's time, were searched for a world with all its land surface coated with metal, it would not be found, and it might be considered an impossible myth. Pellerat looked pleased. I withdraw my earlier remark about soldiers and politicians, my dear fellow. You have a remarkable intuitive sense. Of course, I had to set up controls. I invented 100 falsities based on distortions of actual history and imitating myths of the type I had collected. I then attempted to incorporate my inventions into the model. One of my inventions was even based on Terminus's early history. The computer rejected them all, every one. To be sure, that might have meant I simply lacked the fictional talents to make up something reasonable, but I did my best. I'm sure you did, Genoff. And what did your model tell you about Earth? A number of things of varying degrees of likelihood. A kind of profile. For instance, about 90% of the inhabited planets in the galaxy have rotation periods of between 22 and 26 galactic standard hours. Well, Treviz cut in, I hope you didn't pay any attention to that, Genoff. There's no mystery there. For a planet to be habitable, you don't want it to rotate so quickly that air circulation patterns produce impossibly stormy conditions, or so slowly that temperature variation patterns are extreme. It's a property that's self-selected. Human beings prefer to live on planets with suitable characteristics, and then when all habitable planets resemble each other in these characteristics, some say, "What an amazing coincidence," when it's not amazing at all and not even a coincidence. As a matter of fact, said Pellerat calmly, that's a well-known phenomenon in social science. In physics, too, I believe, but I'm not a physicist, and I'm not certain about that. In any case, it is called the anthropic principle. The observer influences the events he observes by the mere act of observing them, or by being there to observe them. But the question is, where is the planet that served as a model? Which planet rotates in precisely one galactic standard day of 24 galactic standard hours? Treviz looked thoughtful and thrust out his lower lip. You think that might be Earth? Surely galactic standard could have been based on the local characteristics of any world, might it not? Not likely. It's not the human way. Tretor was the capital world of the galaxy for 12,000 years, the most populous world for 20,000 years, yet it did not impose its rotation period of 1.08 galactic standard days on all the galaxy. And Terminus's rotation period is 0.91 GSD, and we don't enforce ours on the planets dominated by us. Every planet makes use of its own private calculations in its own local planetary day system, and for matters of interplanetary importance, converts, with the help of computers, back and forth between LPD and GSD. The galactic standard day must have come from Earth. Why is it a must? For one thing, Earth was once the only inhabited world. So, naturally, its day and year would be standard, and would very likely remain standard out of social inertia as other worlds were populated. Then, too, the model I produced was that of an Earth that rotated on its axis in just 24 galactic standard hours, and that revolved about its sun in just one galactic standard year. Might that not be coincidence? Bellarat laughed. Now it is you who are talking coincidence. Would you care to lay a wager on such a thing happening by coincidence? Well, well, muttered Trevise. In fact, there's more to it. There's an archaic measure of time that's called the month. I've heard of it. It apparently about fits the period of revolution of Earth's satellite about Earth. However, yes, well, one rather astonishing factor of the model is that the satellite I just mentioned is huge, over one quarter the diameter of the Earth itself. Never heard of such a thing, Janov. There isn't a populated planet in the galaxy with a satellite like that. But that's good, said Pellerat with animation. If Earth is a unique world in its production of variegated species and the evolution of intelligence, then we want some physical uniqueness. But what could a large satellite have to do with variegated species, intelligence, and all that? Well, now, there you hit a difficulty. I don't really know, but it's worth examination, don't you think? Trevise rose to his feet and folded his arms across his chest. But what's the problem, then? Look up the statistics on inhabited planets and find one that has a period of rotation and of revolution that are exactly one galactic standard day and one galactic standard year in length, respectively. And if it also has a gigantic satellite, you'd have what you want. I presume from your statement that you have an excellent possibility in mind, that you've done just this, and that you have your world. Pellerat looked disconcerted. Well, now, that's not exactly what happened. I did look through the statistics, or at least I had it done by the astronomy department, and, well, to put it bluntly, there's no such world. Trevise sat down again abruptly. But that means your whole argument falls to the ground. Not quite, it seems to me. What do you mean, not quite? You produce a model with all sorts of detailed descriptions, and you can't find anything that fits. Your model is useless, then. You must start from the beginning. No. It just means that the statistics on populated planets are incomplete. After all, there are tens of millions of them, and some are very obscure worlds. For instance, there is no good data on the population of nearly half, and concerning 640,000 populated worlds, there is almost no information other than their names and sometimes the location. Some galactographers have estimated that there may be up to 10,000 inhabited planets that aren't listed at all. The worlds prefer it that way, presumably. During the imperial era, it might have helped them avoid taxation. And in the centuries that followed, said Trevise cynically, it might have helped them serve as home bases for pirates, and that might have, on occasion, proved more enriching than ordinary trade.
I wouldn't know about that, said Pellerat doubtfully.
Trevise said, just the same, it seems to me that Earth would have to be on the list of inhabited planets, whatever its own desires. It would be the oldest of them all, by definition, and it could not have been overlooked in the early centuries of galactic civilization. And once on the list, it would stay on. Surely we could count on social inertia there. Pellerat hesitated and looked anguished. Actually, there is a planet named Earth on the list of inhabited planets. Trevise stared. I'm under the impression that you told me a while ago that Earth was not on the list.
As Earth, it is not. There is, however, a planet named Gaia.
What has that got to do with it? Gaia.
It's spelled G-A-I-A. It means Earth.
Why should it mean Earth, Janov, any more than anything else? The name is meaningless to me. Pellerat's ordinarily expressionless face came close to a grimace.
I'm not sure you'll believe this, but if I go by my analysis of the myths, there were several different, mutually unintelligible languages on Earth.
What?
Yes. After all, we have 1,000 different ways of speaking across the galaxy.
Across the galaxy, there are certain dialectical variations, but these are not mutually unintelligible. And even if understanding some of them is a matter of difficulty, we all share galactic standard.
Certainly, but there is constant interstellar travel. What if some world was in isolation for a prolonged period?
But you're talking of Earth, a single planet. Where's the isolation?
Earth is the planet of origin, don't forget, where humanity must at one time have been primitive beyond imagining. Without interstellar travel, without computers, without technology at all, struggling up from non-human ancestors.
This is so ridiculous. Pellaret hung his head in embarrassment at that.
There is perhaps no use discussing this, old chap. I never have managed to make it convincing to anyone. My own fault, I'm sure.
Trevise was at once contrite. Janoff, I apologize. I spoke without thinking. These are views, after all, to which I am not accustomed. You have been developing your theories for over 30 years, while I've been introduced to them all at once. You must make allowances. Look, I'll imagine that we have primitive people on Earth who speak two completely different, mutually unintelligible languages.
Half a dozen, perhaps, said Pellaret diffidently. Earth may have been divided into several large land masses, and it may be that there were at first no communications among them. The inhabitants of each land mass might have developed an individual language.
Trevise said with careful gravity, and on each of these land masses, once they grew cognizant of one another, they might have argued an origin question and wondered on which one human beings had first arisen from other animals.
They might very well, Golan. It would be a very natural attitude for them to have.
And in one of those languages, Gaia means Earth, and the word Earth itself is derived from another one of those languages.
Yes, yes.
And while Galactic Standard is the language that descended from the particular language in which Earth means Earth, the people of Earth, for some reason, call their planet Gaia from another of their languages.
Exactly. You are indeed quick, Golan.
But it seems to me that there's no need to make a mystery of this. If Gaia is really Earth, despite the difference in names, then Gaia, by your previous argument, ought to have a period of rotation of just one galactic day, a period of revolution of just one galactic year, and a giant satellite that revolves about it in just 1 month.
Yes, it would have to be so.
Well then, does it or doesn't it fulfill these requirements?
Actually, I can't say. The information isn't given in the tables.
Indeed? Well then, Janoff, shall we go to Gaia and time its periods and stare at his satellite?
I would like to, Golan, Pellaret hesitated. The trouble is that the location isn't given exactly either.
You mean all you have is the name and nothing more, and that is your excellent possibility?
But that is just why I want to visit the Galactic Library.
Well, wait. You say the table doesn't give the location exactly. Does it give any information at all?
It lists it in the Seychelles sector and adds a question mark.
Well, then, Janoff, don't be downcast. We'll go to the Seychelles sector, and somehow we'll find Gaia. Chapter 7. Farmer. 23. Storjen de Ball jogged along the country road outside the university. It was not common practice for second foundationers to venture into the farming world of Trantor. They could do so, certainly, but when they did not venture either far or for long. Jendabal was an exception, and he had, in times past, wondered why. Wondering meant exploring his own mind, something that speakers in particular were encouraged to do. Their minds were at once their weapons and their targets, and they had to keep both offense and defense well honed. Jendabal had decided, to his own satisfaction, that one reason he was different was because he had come from a planet that was both colder and more massive than the average inhabited planet. When he was brought to Trantor as a boy, through the net that was quietly cast throughout the galaxy by agents of the Second Foundation on the lookout for talent, he found himself, therefore, in a lighter gravitational field and a delightfully mild climate. Naturally, he enjoyed being in the open more than some of the others might. In his early years on Trantor, he grew conscious of his puny, undersized frame, and he was afraid that settling back into the comfort of a benign world would turn him flabby indeed. He therefore undertook a series of self-developing exercises that had left him still puny in appearance, but kept him wiry and with a good wind. Part of his regimen were these long walks and joggings, about which some at the speaker's table muttered. Jendabal disregarded their chattering. He kept his own ways, despite the fact that he was first generation. All the others at the table were second and third generation, with parents and grandparents who had been second foundationers, and they were all older than he, too.
What then was to be expected but muttering? By long custom, all minds at the speaker's table were open, supposedly altogether, though it was a rare speaker who didn't maintain a corner of privacy somewhere, in the long run ineffectively, of course. And Jendabal knew that what they felt was envy. So did they. Just as Jendabal knew his own attitude was defensive, overcompensating ambition. And so did they. Besides, Jendabal's mind reverted to the reasons for his ventures into the hinterland. He had spent his childhood in a whole world, a large and expansive one, with grand and variegated scenery, and in a fertile valley of that world, surrounded by what he believed to be the most beautiful mountain ranges in the galaxy. They were unbelievably spectacular in the grim winter of that world. He remembered his former world and the glories of a now distant childhood. He dreamed about it often. How could he bring himself to be confined to a few dozen square miles of ancient architecture? He looked about disparagingly as he jogged. Trantor was a mild and pleasant world, but it was not a rugged and beautiful one. Though it was a farming world, it was not a fertile planet. It never had been. Perhaps that, as much as any other factor, had led to its becoming the administrative center of first an extensive union of planets and then of a galactic empire. There was no strong push to have it be anything else. It wasn't extraordinarily good for anything else. After the Great Sack, one thing that kept Trantor going was its enormous supply of metal. It was a great mine, supplying 50 worlds with cheap alloy steel, aluminum, titanium, copper, magnesium, returning in this way what it had collected over thousands of years, depleting its supplies at a rate hundreds of times faster than the original rate of accumulation. There were still enormous metal supplies available, but they were underground and harder to obtain. The Hamish farmers, who never called themselves Trantorians, a term they considered ill-omened, and which the Second Foundationers therefore reserved for themselves, had grown reluctant to deal with the metal any further. Superstition, undoubtedly. Foolish of them. The metal that remained underground might well be poisoning the soil and further lowering its fertility. And yet, on the other hand, the population was thinly spread, and the land supported them, and there were some sales of metal always. Jendabal's eyes roved over the flat horizon. Trantor was alive geologically, as almost all inhabited planets were, but it had been 100 million years at least since the last major geological mountain-building period had occurred. What uplands existed had been eroded into gentle hills. Indeed, many of them had been leveled during the great metal-coating period of Trantor's history. Off to the south, well out of sight, was the shore of Capital Bay, and beyond that, the Eastern Ocean, both of which had been re-established after the disruption of the underground cisterns. To the north were the towers of Galactic University, obscuring the comparatively squat but wide library, most of which was underground, and the remains of the Imperial Palace still farther north. Immediately on either side were farms, on which there was an occasional building. He passed groups of cattle, goats, chickens, the wide variety of domesticated animals found on any Trantorian farm. None of them paid him any mind. Jendabal thought casually that anywhere in the galaxy, on any of the vast number of inhabited worlds, he would see these animals, and that on no two worlds would they be exactly alike. He remembered the goats of home, and his own tame nanny whom he had once milked. They were much larger and more resolute than the small and philosophical specimens that had been brought to Trantor and established there since the Great Sack. Over the inhabited worlds of the galaxy, there were varieties of each of these animals, in numbers almost beyond counting, and there was no sophisticate on any world who didn't swear by his favorite variety, whether for meat, milk, eggs, wool, or anything else they could produce. As usual, there were no Hamish in view. Jendabal had the feeling that the farmers avoided being seen by those whom they referred to as scowlers, a mispronunciation, perhaps deliberately, of the word scholars in their dialect. Superstition again. Jendabal glanced up briefly at Trantor's sun. It was quite high in the sky, but its heat was not oppressive. In this location, at this latitude, the warmth stayed mild and the cold never bit. Jendabal even missed the biting cold sometimes, or so he imagined. He had never revisited his native world. Perhaps, he admitted to himself, because he didn't want to be disillusioned. He had the pleasant feel of muscles that were sharpened and tightened to keenness, and he decided he had jogged just long enough. He settled down to a walk, breathing deeply. He would be ready for the upcoming table meeting, and for one last push to force a change in policy, a new attitude that would recognize the growing danger from the First Foundation and elsewhere, and that would put an end to the fatal reliance on the perfect working of the plan. When would they realize that the very perfection was the surest sign of danger? Had anyone but himself proposed it, he knew it would have gone through without trouble. As things stood now, there would be trouble, but it would go through just the same, for old Chandos was supporting him, and would undoubtedly continue to do so. He would not wish to enter the history books as the particular first speaker under whom the second foundation had withered. Hamish. Gendebald was startled. He became aware of the distant tendril of mind well before he saw the person. It was Hamish mind, a farmer, coarse and unsubtle. Carefully, Gendebald withdrew, leaving a touch so light as to be undetectable. Second Foundation policy was very firm in this respect. The farmers were the unwitting shields of the Second Foundation. They must be left as untouched as possible. No one who came to Trantor for trade or tourism ever saw anything other than the farmers, plus, perhaps, a few unimportant scholars living in the past. Remove the farmers, or merely tamper with their innocence, and the scholars would become more noticeable, with catastrophic results. That was one of the classic demonstrations which neophytes at the university were expected to work out for themselves. The tremendous deviations displayed on the prime radiant when the farmer minds were even slightly tampered with were astonishing. Gendebald saw him. It was a farmer, certainly Hamish to the core. He was almost a caricature of what a Trantorian farmer should be. Tall and wide, brown-skinned, roughly dressed, arms bare, dark-haired, dark-eyed, a long, ungainly stride. Gendebald felt as though he could smell the barnyard about him. Not too much scorn, he thought. Preem Palver had not minded playing the role of farmer when that was necessary to his plans. Some farmer he was, short and plump and soft. It was his mind that had fooled the teenaged Arcady, never his body. The farmer was approaching him, clumping down the road, staring at him openly, something that made Gendebald frown. No Hamish man or woman had ever looked at him in this manner. Even the children ran away and peered from a distance. Gendebald did not slow his own stride. There would be room enough to pass the other with neither comment nor glance, and that would be best. He determined to stay away from the farmer's mind. Gendebald drifted to one side, but the farmer was not going to have that. He stopped, spread his legs wide, stretched out his large arms as though to block passage, and said,
"Ho, be you scowler?"
Try as he might, Gendebald could not refrain from sensing the wash of pugnacity in the approaching mind. He stopped. It would be impossible to attempt to pass by without conversation, and that would be in itself a weary task. Used as one was to the swift and subtle interplay of sound and expression and thought and mentality that combined to make up the communication between Second Foundationers, it was wearisome to resort to word combination alone. It was like prying up a boulder by arm and shoulder with a crowbar lying nearby. Gendebald said quietly and with careful lack of emotion, "I am a scholar, yes." Gendebald said quietly and with careful lack of emotion, "I am a scholar, yes."
"Ho, you am a scholar. Don't we speak outlandish new? And cannot I see that you be one or am one?"
He ducked his head in a mocking bow.
"Being as you be, small and weazened and pale and upnosed."
"What is it you want of me, Hamishman?" said Gendebald, unmoved.
"I be titled Rufirant, and Carol be my previous."
His accent became noticeably more Hamish. His R's rolled throatily. Gendebald said, "What is it you want with me, Carol Rufirant?"
"And how be you titled, scholar?"
"Does it matter? You may continue to call me scholar."
"If I ask, it matters that I be answered, little up-nosed scholar."
"Well, then, I am titled Steward Gendebald, and I will now go about my business."
"What be your business?"
Gendebald felt the hair prickling on the back of his neck. There were other minds present. He did not have to turn to know there were three more Hamishmen behind him. Off in the distance, there were others. The farmer's smell was strong. "My business, Carol Rufirant, is certainly none of yours."
"Say you so,"
Rufirant's voice rose.
"Mates, he says his business be not ours."
There was a laugh from behind him, and a voice sounded.
"Right he be, for his business be bookmaking and pewter rubbing, and that be not for true men."
"Whatever my business is," said Gendebald firmly, "I will be about it now."
"And how will you do that, wee scowler?"
said Rufirant. "By passing you."
"You would try. You would not fear arm stopping?"
"By you and all your mates, or by you alone?" Gendebald suddenly dropped into thick Hamish accent.
"Are you not for the line?"
Strictly speaking, it was not proper to prod him in this manner, but it would stop a mass attack, and that had to be stopped, lest it force a still greater indiscretion on his part. It worked. Rufirant's expression grew lowering.
"If fair there be, book boy, thou'rt the one to be full of it. Mates, make room. Stand back and let him pass, that he may see if I be feared the lane."
Rifriant lifted his great arms and moved them about. Dendebal did not fear the farmer's pugilistic science, but there was always a chance that a goodly blow might land. Dendebal approached cautiously, working with delicate speed within Rufarant's mind. Not much, just a touch, unfelt, but enough to slow reflexes that crucial notch. Then out and into all the others, who were now gathering in greater numbers. Dendebal's speaker mind darted back and forth with virtuosity, never resting in one mind long enough to leave a mark, but just long enough for the detection of something that might be useful. He approached the farmer cat-like, watchful, aware, and relieved that no one was making a move to interfere. Rufiron struck suddenly, but Dendebal saw it in his mind before any muscle had begun to tighten, and he stepped to one side. The blow whistled past, with little room to spare. Yet Dendebal still stood there, unshaken. There was a collective sigh from the others. Dendebal made no attempt to either parry or return a blow. It would be difficult to parry without paralyzing his own arm, and to return a blow would be of no use, for the farmer would withstand it without trouble. He could only maneuver the man as though he were a bull, forcing him to miss. That would serve to break his morale, as direct opposition would not. Bull-like and roaring, Rufirant charged. Dendebal was ready, and drifted to one side just sufficiently to allow the farmer to miss his clutch. Again the charge. Again the miss. Dendebal felt his own breath begin to whistle through his nose. The physical effort was small, but the mental effort of trying to control without controlling was enormously difficult. He could not keep it up long. He said, as calmly as he could, while batting lightly at Rufirant's fear-depressant mechanism, trying to rouse in a minimalist manner what must surely be the farmer's superstitious dread of scholars, "I will now go about my business." Rufirant's face distorted with rage, but for a moment he did not move. Dendebal could sense his thinking. The little scholar had melted away, like magic. Dendebal could feel the other's fear rise, and for a moment. But then the Hamish rage surged higher and drowned the fear. Rufirant shouted, "Bites! Scholar be dancer! He do duck on nimble toes and scorns the rules of honest Hamish blow for blow. Seize him! Hold him! We will trade blow for blow, then. He may be first striker gift to me, and I will be last striker." Dendebal found the gaps among those who now surrounded him. His only chance was to maintain a gap long enough to get through, then to run, trusting to his own wind and his ability to dull the farmer's will. Back and forth he dodged, with his mind cramping in effort. It would not work. There were too many of them, and the necessity of abiding within the rules of Trantorian behavior was too constricting. He felt hands on his arms. He was held. He would have to interfere with at least a few of the minds. It would be unacceptable, and his career would be destroyed. But his life, his very life, was at hazard. How had this happened? 24. The meeting of the table was not complete. It was not the custom to wait if any speaker were late, nor, thought Shandus, was the table in a mood to wait in any case. Stor Dendebal was the youngest, and far from sufficiently aware of the fact. He acted as though youth were in itself a virtue, and age a matter of negligence on the part of those who should know better. Dendebal was not popular with the other speakers. He was not, in point of fact, entirely popular with Shandus himself, but popularity was not at issue here. Dolora Delarmy broke in on his reverie. She was looking at him out of wide blue eyes, her round face with its accustomed air of innocence and friendliness masking an acute mind, to all but other second foundationers of her own rank, and ferocity of concentration. She said, smiling, "First speaker, do we wait longer?" The meeting had not yet been formally called to order, so that, strictly speaking, she could open the conversation, though another might have waited for Shandus to speak first by right of his title. Shandus looked at her disarmingly, despite the slight breach in courtesy. "Ordinarily we would not, Speaker Delarmy, but since the table meets precisely to hear Speaker Dendebal, it is suitable to stretch the rules."
"Where is he, First Speaker?"
"That, Speaker Delarmy, I do not know." Delarmy looked about the rectangle of faces. There was the First Speaker and what should have been 11 other speakers, only 12. Through 5 centuries, the Second Foundation had expanded its powers and its duties, but all attempts to expand the table beyond 12 had failed. 12 it had been after Selden's death, when the Second First Speaker, Selden himself had always been considered as having been the first of the line, had established it, and 12 it was. Why 12? That number divided itself easily into groups of identical size. It was small enough to consult as a whole, and large enough to do work in subgroups. More would have been too unwieldy, fewer too inflexible. So went the explanations. In fact, no one knew why the number had been chosen or why it should be immutable. But then, even the Second Foundation could find itself a slave to tradition. It took Delarmy only a flashing moment to have her mind twiddle the matter as she looked from face to face and mind to mind, and then, sardonically, at the empty seat, the junior seat. She was satisfied that there was no sympathy at all with Gendebal. The young man, she had always felt, had all the charm of a centipede and was best treated as one. So far, only his unquestioned ability and talent had kept anyone from openly proposing trial for expulsion. Only two speakers had been impeached, but not convicted, in the hemimillennial history of the Second Foundation. The obvious contempt, however, of missing a meeting of the table was worse than many an offense, and Delarmy was pleased to sense that the mood for trial had moved forward rather more than a notch. She said,
"First Speaker, if you do not know the whereabouts of Speaker Gendebal, I would be pleased to tell you."
"Yes, Speaker."
"Who among us does not know that this young man..."
She used no honorific in speaking of him, and it was something that everyone noted, of course.
"Finds business among the Hamish continually. What that business might be, I do not ask. But he is among them now, and his concern with them is clearly important enough to take precedence over this table."
"I believe," said another of the speakers, "that he merely walks or jogs as a form of physical exercise."
Delarmy smiled again. She enjoyed smiling. It cost her nothing.
"The university, the library, the palace, and the entire region surrounding these are ours. It is small in comparison with the planet itself, but it contains room enough, I think, for physical exercise. First Speaker, might we not begin?"
The first speaker sighed inwardly. He had the full power to keep the table waiting, or indeed to adjourn the meeting until a time when Gendebal was present. No first speaker could long function smoothly, however, without at least the passive support of the other speakers, and it was never wise to irritate them. Even Prem Palver had occasionally been forced into cajolery to get his way. Besides, Gendebal's absence was annoying, even to the first speaker. The young speaker might as well learn he was not a law unto himself. And now, as first speaker, he did speak first, saying,
"We will begin. Speaker Gendebal has presented some startling deductions from prime radiant data. He believes that there is some organization that is working to maintain the Selden plan more efficiently than we can, and that it does so for its own purpose. We must, in his view, therefore, learn more about it out of self-defense. You all have been informed of this, and this meeting is to allow you all a chance to question Speaker Gendebal, in order that we may come to some conclusion as to future policy."
It was, in fact, even unnecessary to say this much. Shandus held his mind open, so they all knew. Speaking was a matter of courtesy. Delarmy looked about swiftly. The other 10 seemed content to allow her to take on the role of anti-Gendebal spokesperson. She said,
"Yet Gendebal," again the omission of the honorific, "does not know and cannot say what or who this other organization is."
She phrased it unmistakably as a statement, which skirted the edge of rudeness. It was as much as to say, "I can analyze your mind. You need not bother to explain." The first speaker recognized the rudeness and made the swift decision to ignore it.
"The fact that Speaker Gendebal," he punctiliously avoided the omission of the honorific, and did not even point up the fact by stressing it, "does not know and cannot say what the other organization is, does not mean it does not exist. The people of the First Foundation, through most of their history, knew virtually nothing about us, and, in fact, know next to nothing about us now. Do you question our existence?"
"It does not follow," said Delarmy, "that because we are unknown and yet exist, that anything in order to exist need only be unknown." And she laughed lightly.
"True enough. That is why Speaker Gendebal's assertion must be examined most carefully. It is based on rigorous mathematical deduction, which I have gone over myself, in which I urge you all to consider. It is,"
he searched for a cast of mind that best expressed his views,
"not unconvincing."
"And this first foundationer, Golan Trevise, who hovers in your mind, but whom you do not mention?"
Another rudeness, and this time the first speaker flushed a bit.
"What of him?"
The first speaker said,
"It is Speaker Gendebal's thought that this man Trevise is the tool, perhaps an unwitting one, of this organization, and that we must not ignore him."
"If," said Delarmy, sitting back in her chair and pushing her graying hair backward and out of her eyes, "this organization, whatever it is, exists, and if it is dangerously powerful in its mental capabilities and is so hidden, is it likely to be maneuvering so openly by way of someone as noticeable as an exiled councilman of the First Foundation?"
The first speaker said gravely, "One would think not. And yet I have noticed something that is most disquieting. I do not understand it."
Almost involuntarily, he buried the thought in his mind, ashamed that others might see it. Each of the speakers noted the mental action, and, as was rigorously required, respected the shame. Delarmy did too, but she did so impatiently. She said, in accordance with the required formula,
"May we request that you let us know your thoughts, since we understand and forgive any shame you may feel?"
The first speaker said,
Like you, I do not see on what grounds one should suppose Councilman Trevise to be a tool of the Author Organization, or what purpose he could possibly serve if he were. Yet Speaker Gendebal seems sure of it, and one cannot ignore the possible value of intuition in anyone who has qualified for Speaker. I therefore attempted to apply the plan to Trevise.
To a single person?
Said one of the speakers in low-voiced surprise, and then indicated his contrition at once for having accompanied the question with a thought that was clearly the equivalent of, what a fool.
To a single person, said the first speaker. And you are right. What a fool I am. I know very well that the plan cannot possibly apply to individuals, not even to small groups of individuals. Nevertheless, I was curious. I extrapolated the interpersonal intersections far past the reasonable limits, but I did it in 16 different ways and chose a region rather than a point. I then made use of all the details we know about Trevise, a councilman of the First Foundation does not go completely unnoticed, and of the Foundation's mayor. I then threw it all together rather higgledy-piggledy, I'm afraid.
He paused.
Well, said Delarmy, I gather you... Were the results surprising?
There weren't any results, as you might all expect, said the first speaker. Nothing can be done with a single individual. And yet... I have spent 40 years analyzing results, and I have grown used to obtaining a clear feeling of what the results would be before they were analyzed, and I have rarely been mistaken. In this case, even though there were no results, I developed the strong feeling that Gendebal was right, and that Trevise should not be left to himself.
Why not, First Speaker?
Asked Delarmy, clearly taken aback at the strong feeling in the First Speaker's mind.
I am ashamed, said the First Speaker, that I have let myself be tempted into using the plan for a purpose for which it is not fit. I am further ashamed now that I am allowing myself to be influenced by something that is purely intuitive. Yet I must, for I feel this very strongly. If Speaker Gendebal is right, if we are in danger from an unknown direction, then I feel that when the time comes that our affairs are at a crisis, it will be Trevise who will hold and play the deciding card.
On what basis do you feel this?
Said Delarmy, shocked. First Speaker Shandis looked about the table miserably.
I have no basis. The psycho-historical mathematics produces nothing. But as I watched the interplay of relationships, it seemed to me that Trevise is the key to everything. Attention must be paid to this young man.
25. Gendebal knew that he would not get back in time to join the meeting of the table. It might be that he would not get back at all. He was held firmly, and he tested desperately about him to see how he could best manage to force them to release him. Rufirant stood before him now exultant.
Be you ready now, scholar? Blow for blow, strike for strike, Hamish fashion. Come then, art the smaller, strike then first.
Gendebal said,
Will someone hold thee then as I be held?
Rufirant said,
Let him go. Nah, his arms alane. Leave arms free, but hold legs strong. We want no dancing.
Gendebal felt himself pinned to the ground. His arms were free.
Strike, scholar, said Rufirant. Give us a blow.
And then Gendebal's probing mind found something that answered. Indignation, a sense of injustice and pity. He had no choice. He would have to run the risk of outright strengthening, and then improvising on the basis of... There was no need. He had not touched this new mind, yet it reacted as he would have wished, precisely. He suddenly became aware of a small figure, stocky with long, tangled black hair and arms thrust outward, careening madly into his field of view and pushing madly at the Hamish farmer. The figure was that of a woman. Gendebal thought grimly that it was a measure of his tension and preoccupation that he had not noted this till his eyes told him so.
"Carol Rufirant," she shrieked at the farmer, "art bully and coward. Strike for strike, Hamish fashion. You be 2 times yon scowler's size. You'll be in more sore danger attacking me. Be there renown and passion, yon poor spalp. There'll be shame, I'm thinking. It'll be a fair heap of finger-pointing, and there'll be full saying, yon be Rufirant, renowned baby-smasher." It'll be laughter, I'm thinking, and no decent Hamish woman will be drinking with you, and no decent Hamish woman will be out with you.
Rufirant was trying to stem the torrent, warding off the blows she was aiming at him, attempting weakly to answer with a placating,
Now, sorrah, now, sorrah.
Gendebal was aware that hands no longer grasped him, that Rufirant no longer glared at him, that the minds of all were no longer concerned with him. Surah was not concerned with him either. Her fury was concentrated solely on Rufirant.
Gendebal, recovering, now looked to take measures to keep that fury alive and to strengthen the uneasy shame flooding Rufirant's mind, and to do both so lightly and skillfully as to leave no mark. Again, there was no need. The woman said,
"All of your backstep, look here. If it be not sufficient that this coral heap be like giant to this starveling, there must be five or six more of you ally friends to share in shame and go back to farm with glorious tale of daring do and baby smashing. I held the spalp's arm, you'll say, and giant Rufirant Block pashed him in the face when he was not to backstrike. And you'll say, but I held his foot, so give me also glory. And Rufirant Chunk will say, I could not have him on his lane, so my foremate pinned him, and with the help of all six I gloried on him.
Batsura, said Rufirant, almost twining. I told Scowler he might have first try.
And fearful ye were of the mighty blows of his thin arms. Not so, Rufirant Thickhead. Come, let him go where he be going, the rest of you to your home's backcrawl. If so be, those homes will still find a welcome making for you. You had all best hope the grand deeds of this day be forgotten. And they will not be, for I be spreading them far wide, if you do make me any the more fiercely raging that I be raging now.
They trooped off, quietly, heads hanging, not looking back. Gendebal stared after them, then back at the woman. She was dressed in blouse and trousers, with rough-made shoes on her feet. Her face was wet with perspiration, and she breathed heavily. Her nose was rather large, her breasts heavy, as best Gendebal could tell through the looseness of her blouse, and her bare arms muscular. But then the Hamish women worked in the fields beside their men. She was looking at him sternly, arms akimbo.
"Well, Scowler, why be lagging? Go on to the place of Scowlers. Be afeard. Shall I accompany you?"
Gendebal could smell the perspiration on clothes that were clearly not freshly laundered, but under the circumstances it would be most discourteous to show any repulsion.
"I thank you, Miss Sura."
"The name be Novi," she said gruffly. "Sura Novi. You may say Novi. It be unneeded to Morse."
"I thank you, Novi. You have been very helpful. You be welcome to company me, not for fear of mine, but for company pleasure in you."
And he bowed gracefully, as he might have bowed to one of the young women at the university. Novi flushed, seemed uncertain, and then tried to imitate his gesture.
"Pleasure be mine,"
she said, as though searching for words that would adequately express her pleasure and lend an air of culture. They walked together. Gendebal knew well that each leisurely step made him the more unforgivably late for the table meeting, but by now he had had a chance to think on the significance of what had taken place, and he was icily content to let the lateness grow. The university buildings were looming ahead of them when Sura Novi stopped and said hesitantly,
"Master Scowler?"
Apparently, Gendebal thought, as she approached what she called the place of Scowlers, she grew more polite. He had a momentary urge to say,
"Address you not yon poor spalp?"
But that would embarrass her beyond reason.
"Yes, Novi?"
"Be it very fine-like and rich in place of Scowlers?"
"It's nice," said Gendebal.
"I once dreamed I'd be in place, and I be Scowler."
"Some day," said Gendebal politely, "I'll show it thee."
Her look at him showed plainly she didn't take it for mere politeness. She said,
"I can write. I be taught by schoolmaster. If I write letter to thee,"
she tried to make it casual,
"how do I mark it, so it come to thee?"
"Just say, Speaker's House, Apartment 27, and it will come to me. But I must go, Novi."
He bowed again, and again she tried to imitate the action. They moved off in opposite directions, and Gendebal promptly put her out of his mind. He thought instead of the table meeting, and, in particular, of Speaker Delora Delarmi. His thoughts were not gentle. Chapter 8. Farm Woman. 26. The speakers sat about the table, frozen in their metal shielding. It was as though all, with one accord, had hidden their minds to avoid irrevocable insult to the first speaker after his statement concerning Trevise. Surreptitiously they glanced toward Delarmi, and even that gave away much. Of them all, she was best known for her irreverence. Even Gendebal paid more lip service to convention. Delarmi was aware of the glances, and she knew that she had no choice but to face up to this impossible situation. In fact, she did not want to duck the issue. In all the history of the Second Foundation, no first speaker had ever been impeached for misanalysis, and behind the term, which she had invented as cover-up, was the unacknowledged incompetence. Such impeachment now became possible. She would not hang back.
"First speaker,"
she said softly, her thin, colorless lips more nearly invisible than usual in the general whiteness of her face,
"you yourself say you have no basis for your opinion,
that the psycho-historical mathematics show nothing. Do you ask us to base a crucial decision on a mystical feeling?
The first speaker looked up, his forehead corrugated. He was aware of the universal shielding at the table. He knew what it meant. He said coldly,
I do not hide the lack of evidence. I present you with nothing falsely. What I offer is the strongly intuitive feeling of a first speaker, one with decades of experience, who has spent nearly a lifetime in the close analysis of the Selden plan.
He looked about him with a proud rigidity he rarely displayed, and one by one the mental shields softened and dropped. Delarmy's, when he turned to stare at her, was the last. She said, with a disarming frankness that filled her mind as though nothing else had ever been there,
I accept your statement, of course, first speaker. Nevertheless, I think you might perhaps want to reconsider. As you think about it now, having already expressed shame at having to fall back on intuition, would you wish your remarks to be stricken from the record, if in your judgment they should be?
And Jandabal's voice cut in. What are these remarks that should be stricken from the record? Every pair of eyes turned in unison. Had their shields not been up during the crucial moments before, they would have been aware of his approach long before he was at the door.
All shields up a moment ago, all unaware of my entrance, said Jandabal sardonically. What a commonplace meeting of the table we have here. Was no one on their guard for my coming, or did you all fully expect that I would not arrive?
This outburst was a flagrant violation of all standards. For Jandabal to arrive late was bad enough. For him to then enter unannounced was worse. For him to speak before the first speaker had acknowledged his attendance was worst of all. The first speaker turned to him. All else was superseded. The question of discipline came first.
Speaker Jandabal, he said, you are late. You arrive unannounced. You speak. Is there any reason why you should not be suspended from your seat for 30 days?
Of course. The move for suspension should not be considered until we first consider who it was that made it certain I would be late and why.
Jandabal's words were cool and measured, but his mind clothed his thoughts with anger, and he did not care who sensed it.
Certainly Delarmy sensed it. She said forcefully, This man is mad.
Mad? This woman is mad to say so, or aware of guilt.
First speaker, I address myself to you, and move a point of personal privilege, said Jandabal.
Personal privilege of what nature, speaker?
First speaker, I accuse someone here of attempted murder.
The room exploded as every speaker rose to his or her feet in a simultaneous babble of words, expressions, and mentality. The first speaker raised his arms. He cried,
The speaker must have his chance to express his point of personal privilege.
He found himself forced to intensify his authority mentally in a manner most inappropriate to the place, yet there was no choice. The babble quieted. Jandabal waited, unmoved, until the silence was both audibly and mentally profound. He said,
On my way here, moving along a Hamish road at a distance and approaching at a speed that would have easily assured my arrival in good time for the meeting, I was stopped by several farmers and narrowly escaped being beaten, perhaps being killed. As it was, I was delayed and have but just arrived. May I point out to begin with that I know of no instance since the Great Sack that a second foundationer has been spoken to disrespectfully, let alone manhandled, by one of these Hamish people.
Nor do I, said the first speaker.
Delarmy cried out, Second foundationers do not habitually walk alone in Hamish territory. You invite this by doing so.
It is true, said Jandabal, that I habitually walk alone in Hamish territory. I have walked there hundreds of times in every direction, yet I have never been accosted before. Others do not walk with the freedom that I do, but no one exiles himself from the world or imprisons himself in the university, and no one has ever been accosted. I recall occasions when Delarmy,
and then, as though remembering the honorific too late, he deliberately converted it into a deadly insult.
I mean to say, I recall when Speaker S. Delarmy was in Hamish territory at one time or another, and yet she was not accosted.
Perhaps, said Delarmy with eyes widened into a glare, because I did not speak to them first, and because I maintained my distance, because I behaved as though I deserved respect, I was accorded it.
Strange, said Jandabal, and I was about to say that it was because you presented a more formidable appearance than I did. After all, few dare approach you even here. But tell me, why should it be that of all times for interference the Hamish would choose this day to face me when I am to attend an important meeting of the table?
If it were not because of your behavior, then it must have been chance, said Delarmy. I have not heard that even all of Selden's mathematics has removed the role of chance from the galaxy, certainly not in the case of individual events. Or are you, too, speaking from intuitional inspiration?
There was a soft mental sigh from one or two speakers at this sideways thrust at the first speaker. It was not my behavior. It was not chance. It was deliberate interference, said Gendebal.
How can we know that? Asked the first speaker gently.
He could not help but soften toward Gendebal as a result of Delarmy's last remark.
My mind is open to you, first speaker. I give you and all the table my memory of events.
The transfer took but a few moments. The first speaker said,
Shocking. You behave very well, speaker, under circumstances of considerable pressure. I agree that the Hamish behavior is anomalous and warrants investigation. In the meantime, please join our meeting.
A moment, cut in Delarmy. How certain are we that the speaker's account is accurate?
Gendebal's nostrils flared at the insult, but he retained his level composure.
My mind is open.
I have known open minds that were not open.
I have no doubt of that, speaker, said Gendebal, since you, like the rest of us, must keep your own mind under inspection at all times. My mind, when open, however, is open.
The first speaker said,
Let us have no further...
A point of personal privilege, first speaker, with apologies for the interruption, said Delarmy.
Personal privilege of what nature, speaker?
Speaker Gendebal has accused one of us of attempted murder, presumably by instigating the farmer to attack him. As long as the accusation is not withdrawn, I must be viewed as a possible murderer, as would every person in this room, including you, first speaker.
The first speaker said,
Would you withdraw the accusation, Speaker Gendebal?
Gendebal took his seat and put his hands down upon its arms, gripping them tightly as though taking ownership of it, and said,
I will do so as soon as someone explains why a Hamish farmer, rallying several others, should deliberately set out to delay me on my way to this meeting. A thousand reasons, perhaps, said the first speaker. I repeat that this event will be investigated. Will you, for now, Speaker Gendebal, and in the interest of continuing the present discussion, withdraw your accusation?
I cannot, first speaker. I spent long minutes trying, as delicately as I might, to search his mind for ways to alter his behavior without damage, and failed. His mind lacked the give it should have had. His emotions were fixed, as though by an outside mind.
Delarmy said with a sudden little smile, And you think one of us was the outside mind? Might it not have been your mysterious organization that is competing with us, that is more powerful than we are?
It might, said Gendebal.
In that case, we who are not members of this organization that only you know of are not guilty, and you should withdraw your accusation. Or can it be that you are accusing someone here of being under the control of this strange organization?
Perhaps one of us here is not quite what he or she seems.
Perhaps, said Gendebal stolidly, quite aware that Delarmy was feeding him rope with a noose at the end of it.
It might seem, said Delarmy, reaching the noose and preparing to tighten it, that your dream of a secret, unknown, hidden, mysterious organization is a nightmare of paranoia. It would fit in with your paranoid fantasy that Hamish farmers are being influenced, that speakers are under hidden control.
I am willing, however, to follow this peculiar thought line of yours for a while longer.
Which of us here, Speaker, do you think is under control? Might it be me?
Gendebal said, I would not think so, Speaker. If you were attempting to rid yourself of me in so indirect a manner, you would not so openly advertise your dislike for me.
A double-double cross, perhaps, said Delarmy.
She was virtually purring.
That would be a common conclusion in a paranoid fantasy.
So it might be. You are more experienced in such matters than I. Speaker Lestimjani interrupted hotly.
See here, Speaker Gendebal, if you are exonerating Speaker Delarmy, you are directing your accusations the more tightly at the rest of us. What grounds would any of us have to delay your presence at this meeting, let alone wish you dead?
Gendebal answered quickly, as though he had been waiting for the question. When I entered, the point under discussion was the striking of remarks from the record, remarks made by the first speaker. I was the only speaker not in a position to hear those remarks. Let me know what they were, and I rather think I will tell you the motive for delaying me. The first speaker said,
I had stated, and it was something to which Speaker Delarmy and others took serious exception, that I had decided, on the basis of intuition and of a most inappropriate use of psychohistorical mathematics, that the entire future of the plan may rest on the exile of First Foundationer Golan Trevise.
Gendebal said, What other speakers may think is up to them. For my part, I agree with this hypothesis. Trevise is the key. I find his sudden ejection by the First Foundation too curious to be innocent.
Delarmy said, Would you care to say, Speaker Gendebal, that Trevise is in the grip of this mystery organization, or that the people who exiled him are?
Is perhaps everyone and everything in their control except you and the first speaker, and me, whom you have declared to be uncontrolled?
Gendebal said, These ravings require no answer. Instead, let me ask if there is any speaker here who would like to express agreement on this matter with the first speaker and myself. You have read, I presume, the mathematical treatment that I have, with the first speaker's approval, circulated among you. There was silence. I repeat my request, said Gendebal. Anyone? There was silence. Gendebal said, First speaker, you now have the motive for delaying me. The first speaker said,
State it explicitly.
You have expressed the need to deal with Trevise, with his first foundationer. It represents an important initiative in policy, and if the speakers had read my treatment, they would have known in a general way what was in the wind. If nevertheless they had unanimously disagreed with you, unanimously, then by traditional self-limitation you would have been unable to go forward. If even one speaker backed you, then you would be able to implement this new policy. I was the one speaker who would back you, as anyone who had read my treatment would know, and it was necessary that I must at all costs be kept from the table. That trick proved nearly successful, but I am now here, and I back the first speaker. I agree with him, and he can, in accordance with tradition, disregard the disagreement of the 10 other speakers. Delarmy struck the table with her fist.
The implication is that someone knew in advance what the first speaker would advise, knew in advance that Speaker Gendebal would support it, and that all the rest would not, that someone knew what he could not have known. There is the further implication that this initiative is not to the liking of Speaker Gendebal's paranoia-inspired organization, and that they are fighting to prevent it, and that, therefore, one or more of us is under the control of that organization.
The implication is there, agreed Gendebal. Your analysis is masterly.
Whom do you accuse?
Cried out Delarmy. No one. I call upon the first speaker to take up the matter. It is clear that there is someone in our organization who is working against us. I suggest that everyone working for the Second Foundation should undergo a thorough mental analysis. Everyone, including the speakers themselves, even including myself and the first speaker. The meeting of the table broke up in greater confusion and greater excitement than any on record. And when the first speaker finally spoke the phrase of adjournment, Gendebal, without speaking to anyone, made his way back to his room. He knew well that he had not one friend among the speakers, that even whatever support the first speaker could give him would be half-hearted at best. He could not tell whether he feared for himself or for the entire Second Foundation. The taste of doom was sour in his mouth. 27. Gendebal did not sleep well. His waking thoughts and his sleeping dreams were alike engaged in quarreling with Delora Delarmy. In one passage of one dream, there was even a confusion between her and the Hamish farmer Rufirant, so that Gendebal found himself facing an out-of-proportion Delarmy advancing upon him with enormous fists and a sweet smile that revealed needle-like teeth. He finally woke later than usual, with no sensation of having rested, and with the buzzer on his night table in muted action. He turned over to bring his hand down upon the contact.
Yes, what is it?
Speaker. The voice was that of the floor proctor, rather less than suitably respectful.
A visitor wishes to speak to you.
A visitor? Gendebal punched his appointment schedule, and the screen showed nothing before noon. He pushed the time button. It was 8:32 a.m. He said peevishly, Who in space and time is it?
Will not give a name, Speaker.
Then, with clear disapproval,
One of these Hamishers, Speaker, arrived at your invitation.
The last sentence was said with even clearer disapproval. Let him wait in the reception room till I come down. It will take time. Gendebal did not hurry. Throughout the morning ablutions, he remained lost in thought. That someone was using the Hamish to hamper his movements made sense, but he would like to know who that someone was, and what was this new intrusion of the Hamish into his very quarters? A complicated trap of some sort? How in the name of Selden would a Hamish farmer get into the university? What reason could he advance? What reason could he really have? For one fleeting moment, Gendebal wondered if he ought to arm himself. He decided against it almost at once, since he felt contemptuously certain of being able to control any single farmer on the university grounds without any danger to himself, and without any unacceptable marking of a Hamish mind. Gendebal decided he had been too strongly affected by the incident with Carol Rufirant the day before. Was it the very farmer, by the way? No longer under the influence, perhaps, of whatever or whoever it was, he might well have come to Gendebal to apologize for what he had done, and with apprehension of punishment. But how would Rufirant know where to go, whom to approach? Gendebal swung down the corridor resolutely and entered the waiting room. He stopped in astonishment, then turned to the proctor, who was pretending to be busy in his glass-walled cubicle.
Proctor, you did not say the visitor was a woman.
The proctor said quietly,
Speaker, I said a Hamisher. You did not ask further.
Minimal information, Proctor. I must remember that as one of your characteristics. And he must check to see if the proctor was a Delarmy appointee. And he must remember from now on to note the functionaries who surrounded him, Lowly's, whom it was too easy to ignore from the height of his still new speakership. Are any of the conference rooms available? The proctor said, Number 4 is the only one available, Speaker. It will be free for 3 hours. He glanced briefly at the Hamish woman, then at Jendabal with blank innocence. We will use Number 4, Proctor, and I would advise you to mind your thoughts. Jendabal struck, not gently, and the proctor's shield closed far too slowly. Jendabal knew well it was beneath his dignity to manhandle a lesser mind, but a person who was incapable of shielding an unpleasant conjecture against a superior ought to learn not to indulge in one. The proctor would have a